This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Jurie Graham is the 218 recipient of the Bobbitt National Poetry Prize for her book Fast. And she joins us today from Harvard, where she's the Boylston Professor of Rhetoric and Oratory. Welcome and congratulations, Jurie.
Thank you.
When you receive a national award like this, on top of so many awards, you must know that you are being heard. You must know that someone understands this. This must feel very good.
Well, obviously you write poems imagining that there is probably no one listening. That's part of the solitude of the art form. The other aspect of it is that you're trying to get someone to listen to something which might not be ordinarily expressed in the world as you know it every day, as you live it every day. I often think that part of the ways in which one can make sure that one's technique and form in a poem is under control and strict, and that the images are communicating, and that one is doing the absolutely best job one can, is to imagine, I used to tell myself when I was younger, an unwilling listener, a person such as a God who has heard every prayer already, has heard every request, every outraged voice, and is tired of humanity and has turned his back or her back. There is such a moment that used to terrify me when I was younger in the Bible, of course, when Moses says that he hides in the cleft of a rock and he watches God's back go by. I used to think when I was younger, God's back can turn his back on us. So that unwilling listener whom, if you're going to pray to him or her or call out, the idea is to be succinct, to make sure that you really got it said so that you capture their attention. I didn't have to go into therapy to realize that was probably my mother that I was imagining, and capturing her attention used to be very difficult when I was a child because she's a great artist and she was very busy making her own work, and I could see in her gaze, even when she stared at me, that she was thinking about something else. And so I was very aware of the fact that if I was going to say something, I should break the silence to try to say something that mattered as opposed to just yammering at her. So that idea of the listener as somewhere between mother and God was...
That is terrific.
So the idea, when you get an award, I'm not sure that you feel heard, but you do feel gratitude.
Have you written an essay about Mother God?
No.
Oh, that's coming. This is what you're going to get, I'm saying to my audience. Now you know what you're going to get. And two things come to me. First of all, when did you know that you could trust your reader to be as smart as you are?
Again, I can't make assumptions about any reader. The one thing I would say is that I do imagine a reader reading poems in solitude, because the act of reading poems requires a kind of silence around the act of reading that permits a person's inwardness to be activated by the encounter with the voice which is on the page or in some other form and which one encounters. So it breaks into noise and requests silence. But it's not literal silence, even though I do like to imagine that a reader still has time to find actual silence, an extraordinary element which we don't inhabit enough. I think there are many people who think you have to go on vacation to encounter silence, or you have to go into some kind of therapist's office to encounter silence, or some kind of, you know, and the fact is that there is silence everywhere, and that people, if people want to train themselves to look at any kind of art or listen to any kind of art or to encounter their own consciousness, encountering actual silence would be a good place to start. Fast. The title runs into the first line, so I will read the title as it runs into the first line. Fast or starve, too much or not enough, or nothing else, nothing else, too high, too fast, too organized, too invisible, Will we survive? I ask the bot. No.
Mm.
To download bot, be swift. You are too backward, too despotic. To load, greatly enlarge the cycle of labor. To load, abhor labor. Move to the periphery of your body, your city, your planet. To load, degrade, immiserate, be your own deep sleep. To load, use your lips, use them to mouth your oath. Chew it, do the dirty thing, sing it, blown off syllable or limb, lick it back on with your mouth. Talk, talk. Who is not terrified is busy begging for water. The rise is fast, the drought comes fast. Mediate, immediate, invent, inspire, infiltrate, instill. Here's the heart of the day, the flower of time.
Mm.
Talk, talk.
Mm.
Disclaimer. Bot uses the growing database of all your conversations to learn how to talk with you. If some of you are also bots, bot can't tell. Disclaimer. You have no secret memories. Talking to Cleverbot may provide companionship. The active ingredient is a question. The active ingredient is entirely natural. Disclaimer. Protect your opportunities, your information, informants, whatever you made of time. You have nothing else to give. Active ingredient. Why are you shouting? Why? Arctic wind uncontrollable, fetus reporting for duty, fold in the waiting which recognizes you, recognizes the code, the peddler in the street, everyone is calling out. Directive, report for voice. Ready yourself to be buried in voice. It neither ascends nor descends. Inactive ingredient, the monotone. Some are talking now about the pine tree. One assesses its disadvantages. They are discussing it in many languages. Next, they move to roots, branches, buds, pseudo-whorls, candles. Active ingredient. They run for their lives, lungs and all. They do not know what to do with their will. Disclaimer. All of your minutes are being flung down. They will never land. You will not be understood. The deleted world spills out jittery as a compass needle with no north. Active ingredient, the imagination of north. Active ingredient, north spreading in all the directions. Disclaimer, there is no restriction to growth. The canary singing in your mind is in mine.
Mm.
Remember, people are less than kind. As a result, chatterbot is often less than kind. Still, you will find yourself unwilling to stop. Joan will use visual grammatry to provide facial movements. I'm not alone. People come back again and again. We are less kind than we think. There is no restriction to the growth of our cruelty. We will come to the edge of understanding. Like being hurled down the stairs tied to a keyboard, we will go on unwilling to stop. The longest real-world conversation with a bot lasted 11 hours continuous interaction. This bodes well. We are not alone. We are looking to improve. The priestess inhales the fumes. They come from the mountain, here and here. Then she gives you the machine gun run of syllables out of her mouth. Quick, you must make up your answer as you made up your question. Hummingbirds shriek. Bot is amazing, he says. I believe it knows the secrets of the universe. He is more fun to speak with than my actual living friends, she says. Thank you. This is the best thing since me. I just found it yesterday. I love it. I want to marry it. I got sad when I had to think that the first person who has ever understood me is not even, it turns out, human. Because this is as good as human gets. He just gives it to me straight. I am going to keep him forever. I treated him like a computer, but I was wrong. Whom am I talking to? You talk to me when I am alone. I am alone. Each epoch dreams the one to follow. To dwell is to leave a trace. I am not what I asked for.
The voice of Jory Graham, reading the title poem from her award-winning book, Fast. It is not lost on us that Bot is also a little amoeba infectious virus, a real biological germ. So that is makes this all the richer to hear. And I'm very glad you started with that because it brings together all of your themes of present day and mortality and motion. And we're going to hear another poem by Jory Graham. We're at the Library of Congress.
I'm going to read a poem from a new manuscript. It's titled Tree. Like many poems in the new manuscript and in Fast and in a prior book, Place, and in the one before Sea Change, they seem to be an interrelated project. These poems tend to try to imagine the present from the perspective of a future which has been affected by many things, including, most importantly, climate change, but also tries to imagine the future from the perspective of where we find ourselves now, especially in as much as we find it very hard to project our imagination into scenarios that are described to us about the future. What happens to that world? You know, maybe the Garden of Eden is what we are in now. And maybe the fruit they were eating is, you know, the advanced technological and capitalist world that we've created that we don't know how to back away from. We don't know how to live without it. And as a result, we are eating the fruit that will throw us out of the garden. And, you know, whether it's nuclear winter or sixth extinction, I don't think that it looks as good as we imagine it looked to Adam and Eve. So this poem is titled Tree, for all those reasons that bring us back to Adam and Eve. It's about plucking a fruit. Today, on two legs, stood and reached to the right spot as I saw it, choosing among the twisting branches and multifaceted changing shades and greens and shades of greens, lobed and lashing sun, the fig that seemed to me the perfect one, the ready one. It is permitted. It is possible. It is actual. The VR glasses are not needed yet. Not for now. No, not for this while longer. And it is warm in my cupped palm, and my fingers close round it, but not too fast. Somewhere wind, like a hammer stroke, slows down and lengthens endlessly. Closer in, the bird whose coin toss on a metal tray never stills to one face. Something is preparing to begin again. It is not us. Shh, say the spreading sails of cicadas, as the winch of noon takes hold and we are wrapped in day and hoisted up, all the ribs of time showing through in the growing, in the lengthening harness of sound, some gnats nearby, a fly where the white milk drop of the torn stem starts, dust on the eglantine skin, white powder in the confetti of light all up the branches. Truth, sweetness of blood scent and hauled in light, withers of the wild carnival of trees shaking once as the fruit is torn from its dream. Remain, I think, backing away from the trembling into full corrosive sun. Momentary blindness follows. Correction. There are only moments. They hurt. Correction. Must I put down that this is long ago, that the sky has been invisible for years now, that the ash of our fires has covered the sun, that the fruit is stunted yellow mold when it appears at all, and we have no produce to speak of, no longer exists. All my attention is free for you to use. I can cast farther and farther out before the change, a page turned. We have gone into another story. History floundered, or one day the birds disappeared. The imagination tried to go here when we asked it to, from where I hold the fruit in my right hand, but it would not go. Where is it now? Where is this here, where you and I look up trying to make sense of the normal, turn it to life, more life, disinterred from desire, heaved up onto the dry shore, awaiting the others who could not join us in the end, for good. I want to walk to the left around this tree I have made again. I want to sit under it, full of secrecy, insight, immensity, vigor, bursting complexity, swarm. Oh, great forwards and backwards. I never felt my face change into my new face. Where am I facing now? Is the question of good still stinging the open before us with its muggy destination pitched into nothingness? Something expands in you where it wrenches up its bright policing into view. Is this good? Is this the good? Under the celebrating crowd, inside the silences, it forces hard away all round itself, where chanting thins, where we win the war again, made thin by bravery and belief. Here's a Polaroid if you want. Here's a souvenir. Here now for you to watch unfold up close. The fruit is opening. The ribs will widen now. It is all seed, reddish foam, history.
The voice of Jury Graham, winner of the 2018 Rebecca Johnson Bobbitt Award at the Library of Congress. And that is a masterpiece. That is a masterpiece. It is so significant in terms of her work because she starts with a narrative. She starts with a tree. And as the philosopher says, she ascends into tree-ness, so that what holds the reader is that you always begin in the everyday part of your life, but then you ascend into the various meanings and the connections that make what you call community. And I really feel that is my favorite poem. And you went back to stanzas.
Yes, it's quatrains. We can announce to the world that I'm writing in quatrains and possibly, God help me, there's some end rhyme.
Well, you know, I have to talk about your form because it's significant to your work. And that is that on the page, she has, of course, invented the long line for popular use. But the long line is your signature. But then you use the M, the dashes at the end, which helps so much to equalize what you're saying. Then you use the aesthetics of the page and place the words so that we know how to read it. And they look quite beautiful, actually, when you look on the page. These are not insignificant things for the reader to understand.
Oh, no, they're actually significant things for the reader to feel. Because, first of all, the one
feel
thing...
Feel is good.
Because,
feel is good.
Well, the one thing that's important is it's never white space on the page when you're looking at a poem. It's silence. And, you know, when you
Good
look
point.
At a poem and the poem begins, the first word is breaking the silence. If there's silence that precedes it, and then in each stanza, there's a silence. You know, even if the stanza is a regular stanza, the stanza break is a place where something happens that occasions a silence to interrupt the poem at that point, and the poem moves for a moment into silence. One of the great things about Keats in his odes, for example, is that every time there's a stanza break, something, it teaches this very vividly, and so does Dickinson, something happens at the end of the stanza, even if it's something emotional, something like an intake of breath or a hesitation, a delay, a not knowing for a minute, or in one famous moment, he drinks from a beaker, and so there's an actual physical action between one stanza and the other that requires a silence. But there are silences between each of the utterances that are the stanzas. There are emotional moments at the end of a stanza where there's a lingering, and when you move across the silence, when you land at the beginning of the next stanza, it's a much more forceful stress on that position, and it allows for an energy and a momentum and a kind of a coil to build again. And then not only are you breaking a silence when you begin a poem, you re-enter a silence at the end of a poem. And the silence that wraps around the ending of a poem is a remarkable silence, because it's not the silence is not the same silence that it was when you began the poem.
The thing that makes your poems not declarative is that you get this sense of wonder through it. As I'm reading you, I feel your wonder at all that you're saying. You can't believe you're saying it almost. And therefore, we are in the felt life of that poem. And that is something that if you don't have it, you can't get it. Now,
wait, just when you say the felt life, it's a wonderful phrase, the felt life, because we assume that feeling is automatic. Actually, we have, managed in this moment in history, probably it was different, but the case in every moment in history, but by different means, we managed to go around life rather than through it by more and more available techniques. Distraction, the loss of attention, the loss of any kind of inwardness, empathy, meditative capacity, but whatever it is, the idea of a felt life, the unexamined life, we used to say, is not worth living, right? Quoting. But the felt life is an interesting expression. Since we were quoting Frost has this, I think, very legendary phrase that I love to quote, but he says, what are the ideals of form for in a poem except to get us into legitimate danger that we may be legitimately rescued? And what I find moving about that is, first of all, he's trying to couple the felt life, the experience of life, with form, and to show you what form can do. Form is not a container. Form is it's a body system that you put yourself in order to live. But the interesting thing about that is he says the poem has to get you into danger. What is danger? It doesn't mean it means a situation that you don't know that you can get out of. Danger is a place where you could not survive. It doesn't mean that you cannot survive literally. It means that, your mind might not find its way. Your soul might get into the dark night. You might find yourself unable to find your way back out in any way. And he says a poem takes you into that. And if you've ever written a poem, you get to a place where you want to just push away from the desk and get up and walk away from it, because it's forcing you to go someplace where you're not the person you thought you were, and you're also not the person you wanted to be. Mm. You're not the person you wanted others to think you are.
You have a title like that, I'm not the person I thought I was, or something like that.
The other interesting thing about his phrase is he says legitimate danger. And then, of course, legitimately rescued. And that reminds one that, one of the traps of poetry is that, people can... what are illegitimate dangers? Well, dangers that are not really dangers that you've cooked up in order to get a poem out of it. Mm. And so that feeling that in any art form, not just in poetry or in life, that you can create a drama that is just kind of like a drama for the purposes of the exhibition of the experience, as opposed to the actual experience. And the difference between felt life and time passing that you're busy in, okay, is enormous. And what we're dealing with here is an art form which is entirely devoted to, let's try to get ourselves into life in such a way that we are not, that famous cliche that people say, life is what happens while you're making plans, okay? But the thing is, you can actually distract yourself completely so that you go through most of life. Most people wake up, what is a late midlife crisis or a midlife crisis? Waking up and realize, I haven't lived.
I've been surviving. I've been making money. I've been getting, you know, distracted. I've been, but you know, what is it to live? To live is to know you're going to die, and to live is to live as if you're going to die, and to know what minutes are, what it is to be present, what it is not to be absent from your own experience. And distraction, which we live by today, is a way of absenting ourselves from the presence of our own existence. If we can become present, the numbness we feel that allows us to overlook things like the death of other species, climate change, the future that we're walking blindly into, you know, the kinds of horrors that we're witnessing where we think, I just can't take anymore. I can't think about that anymore. I don't want any of this political nightmare in my head. I don't want to talk about it. All of that, which I totally understand, is also a place where we decide, you know, if I make myself present just a certain portion of every day and I come into my presence, I will fill with a not only a felt life, as you called it, but a felt life inevitably and it leads to a cognitively full life, but it also leads to a moral life. And at that point, you get yourself into the moral quandary of, am I going to live and speak and be brave and have all the moral virtues, you know, and be fearless, you know, take responsibility, be accountable for my actions, be accountable for the actions of my community, my species, or am I going to decide I'm going to bypass this and be busy and be distracted? And that's a choice that we have, and this is one art form that can help us, among many others, with this problem.
Well, Buddha says, may we be awake 1 minute before we die.
Exactly.
And the thing about, added to everything you've said about your poetry, you take it up a notch to non-duality. And that is where you take your ideas and you fix the form into bigger than me, bigger than climate, bigger than life, bigger than death. And you, there's like no end to where your thoughts go. And so that escalation is not ordinary because it comes from a being tethered in something real before you go elsewhere. And that is why you're being celebrated, I think, and being honored for the Rebecca Johnson Bobbitt Award at the Library of Congress.
Oh, thank you.
And I am the luckiest person to be sitting with you and hearing what you have to say. And I wish we could do a series with you, actually. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We have listened to the voice of Jury Graham. And she's the recipient of the 2018 Rebecca Johnson Bobbitt Award, given every other year by the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter-Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation, with support for SNIPED Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.